Really good to be back with you. What a beautiful prayer. Thank you so kindly for praying for me and for all of us as we encounter God's word today. I'm so excited to be back. I wanted to be back with you last week, but as it turns out, I was a little unwell. I just couldn't quite make it. I'd planned to be better, but I hadn't. I had an operation last Monday. I wanted to correct something. Well, I'll tell you about this for two reasons. First of all, I wanted to correct something because Daniel told you about it last week, and he told you that I had plastic surgery, which is technically true, but somebody asked me through the week, did you have something cosmetic done? And I don't have enough money to spend on that. But second of all, you can't improve on perfection. Third of all, it hurts me to laugh. That's the other reason why I'm telling you. Don't make me laugh because it hurts. But the third reason is that if I was going to get something cosmetic done, I would have got something taken away in the middle here rather than, yeah. So that's first of all, yeah. When I was a kid, I was 18 years old, I went in an army boxing competition because I was in the military at that time. And had my nose broken pretty badly, and I thought I knew what to do. I just fixed it up myself in the mirror. And as it turned out, it wasn't really good inside. So anyway, I had one nostril that was almost completely closed. And it wasn't bothering me too much, except in the last few years I've started getting kicked out of bed at night because it sounds like there's a chainsaw coming from one side of the bed that isn't my wife's. So we've decided to try and rectify that. If I start to laugh and I make a funny sort of face, you'll know what I'm doing. I'm actually in incredible pain when I laugh. Okay, so that's what's going on. But I'm excited to continue this study of Ruth together, and I think the pastoral team so far have done an amazing job of introducing and going through the guts of this book. But this is the most important, critical culmination part of it, the fourth chapter, and I've called it Redeemer of the Covenant. The Gospel of Ruth in chapter 4. So we're going to turn to chapter 4. And as you're doing that, we've already prayed, so we'll get right into the Word of God. And as we're doing that, I want to tell you about my covenant that took place on the 9th of April in 2006. Here's a picture of it here. And a beautiful young lady that was up the front here singing just a moment ago, you can see she's in that picture and you can see my back. You can see her sister, her older sister in the background, ugly crying as we... made our vows together. And I don't know how I convinced such a beautiful woman to marry me, but somehow I sucked her in, so I was pretty happy about that. And here's another picture of that day. Doesn't she look beautiful? Yeah, really, really nice. And there's us. They put us in this, we hired this kind of convertible old, what was it, a Valiant or something? Where's my wife sitting? Oh, she's hiding. Oh, yeah, there she is. Was it a Valiant or something, our car, bridal car? Something. Anyway, a convertible something or other, older car, and went for a drive along the beach there in Townsville and felt very special. This moment of making our vows one to another. If you're somebody that's married, I just want you to cast your mind back to the moment when you stood before God and the people you love and committed one to another. It's an important moment, isn't it? It's very important. And I just want you to keep that in mind as we go on. So our story so far, you remember in the first chapter of the book of Ruth, we had these two women. Obviously, Naomi has gone, or she's been led by her husband into a foreign land, the land of Moab, and her husband has died, and so has her sons. So these two widows and their mother-in-law are left together. What are they going to do? Naomi decides to go back to the land of Israel and settle in the region of Judah, and as she does, her daughter-in-law Ruth decides that she's going to accompany her, and there's those beautiful words, "Your people will be my people, and your God my God," and so this mother-in-law and this daughter-in-law go back together, and they decide to try and set up a bit of a household back in God's country, God's chosen land there amongst the people. They're living a lifestyle of subsistence. They're in mourning. They're in poverty. And Ruth makes a decision that she's going to go out and glean in the fields. And she happens to do so in the field of Boaz, who, as it turns out, is a relative of of her dead husband. And Naomi crafts a plan, which she instructs Ruth to follow. And she says, I want you to take off your mourning clothes and put on clothes that indicate and signal that you are available for marriage. And then I want you to indicate to him by the ritual that you studied last time, the process that that Daniel went through with you, that you're available. And so Boaz makes a decision that he's going to pursue Ruth and attempt to marry her. But there are some legal obstacles that he has to go through because of the situation that she's in. So with that, I want to let you know about the background that's going on here. So it's difficult sometimes for us to imagine. And when we read some of these Bible stories, the culture is so distant from us and the practices are so far removed from the sorts of things that we do that it's very strange and difficult for us to understand. So I want to give you some background here so that you can have some conception of some of the dynamics that are at play and the importance of some of the dynamics that are at play as this narrative unfolds. By the way, when you think about covenants, has anyone here ever tried to build in a development and you had to sign a covenant? I'm not going to, you know, make a house over 5 stories tall. I'm not going to paint my walls pink. You know, all those, there's lengthy, yep, okay, so, yep, Kev. Yeah, it can be a lengthy kind of difficult document. People generally in our society, when we think of the idea of covenant, we don't think of positive things. Even marriage has come to be associated with negativity in society generally in the 21st century in the West. But I came across this cartoon. It was a little bit sad, actually. It's making fun of marriage, and it says this is a guy at work. He's obviously rings someone and says, "Sorry, Jeff, lunch is off. I'm still bound by this restrictive covenant." And there's his wife telling him that he's not allowed to go to lunch. I think you might chuckle at that. I think it's a bit of a sad kind of reflection of our view of things like marriage and those sorts of agreements, isn't it? I suppose. So it's difficult for us to understand ancient people's practices because our society is removed. But try to picture this, okay? Just try to picture your life if this was the situation. First of all, there's no supermarkets. In a supermarket, you've got cheap access to food, okay? Whatever you have to, the definition of cheap might change from year to year, but comparatively cheap, okay? So in this society, all you have to eat is what you grow, or what you raise, or what you hunt, or what you're able to trade with other people. So there's not an easily accessible, wide and diverse a range of foods. That's the first thing. Secondly, there's no electricity whatsoever. So a lot of hard work is involved in getting any sort of light or warmth. There's no easily accessible clean water. That requires a lot of work by someone or other too to walk long distances to bring it back into the house. There's no police force. Have you ever, now you may or may not like the police when you get pulled over for a speeding ticket, but how do you feel about the fact that if something goes on in your house at night with somebody with a mask on, you can ring someone and someone will turn up and there'll be some sort of response? Like, that's a positive thing, isn't it? Like, there's a level of security in your life because you know that it's not all up to you to defend your property. There's an institution out there that's devoted to that. There's none of that in place, okay? Nothing like that. There's no sort of medical care that we would think of as being really medical care today. They're very primitive. You know, one day I'll tell you about some of the cures that were extant at the time that used to exacerbate problems. Here's some more things. No age pension, no unemployment benefit, no DSP. If you can't work, you can't eat. And so as you, maybe if you hurt yourself and you're unable to work, or if as you get older, or for whatever reason, if you're not able to sustain yourself by some sort of hard work and living, you become very vulnerable, very quickly. There's no aged care facilities. There's no easily accessible education. Education is always a pathway out of subsistence living. If you, in these days, knew how to read and write, then, you know, people might pay you to sit down and write letters. It meant that you didn't have to be in the fields every day. It was a pathway out of just eking along a survival, and it was very difficult to get an education. Only very, very rich people usually had access to it, or people that were appointed by the ruling class. And your whole life is lived with the constant threat of either suffering or death by violence, starvation, disease, or succumbing to the elements. So one scholar has compared living in the ancient Near East as being something like being in the middle of a river while it's flowing, and you're balancing your tippy toes on a rock, and your nose and mouth are just out of the water, and it's flowing downstream and you're just barely surviving. And if there's any change whatsoever, like the water goes a bit faster or you trip or the water gets a bit higher, then you die. That you're barely making it by, you know, you're barely eking by. And that's the way it is. And the way that people were able to secure some sort of security for food, some sort of security in relationships, some sort of security in terms of their physical safety was with covenants. They were the answer. Because with a covenant, you could negotiate a relationship with another person that meant that you could have a bit of dependability. Okay, I grow wheat. My friend over here grows grapes. We will enter into a covenant, a relationship between one another, overseen by the God of heaven or by the gods or whoever I hold to be holy. And I will promise that every year I will give you some of my grain and you give me some of your grapes. And we will enter into that agreement. And I'll know, and I can bank on the fact that every year I will have both bread and wine. Does that make sense? And that, excuse me. They had all sorts of these covenants were set up in all sorts of different directions. Very important covenants set up with kings, because kings had access to an army. So if you did a little bit of service in that army, maybe, and then you'd agree to do some service in that army as a soldier, and then that king would guarantee you protection. And so there's a level of security that was afforded by that and so forth. So this is what a covenant is in the ancient Near East. It's a covenant was a free will negotiated, mutually beneficial contract used to secure safety, providence, security, or care for self or for family. It was a formalization of a relationship. It appealed to a higher power to ensure the terms were kept, and it always did that. All of the ancient covenants always appeal to the gods. Usually there's a sacrifice or something that happens. And it was solemnized with some kind of ritual offering or sign. And the most common important covenant of all was that of marriage. Very, very important. Marriage was crucial in the ancient world. Marriage formed the basic unit of society. It ensured cooperative effort, protection, and provision for women, children, and the aged. So this is your aged care plan, is marriage, because you're going to have a son that's going to take care of you when you get old. Does that make sense? Because there's no way you can go. You can't sell your house and go to an aged care facility. If you can't feed yourself, you die. If you don't have a son that can provide for you, you die. So this is your aged care plan, is marriage. And it's somewhere for women to be protected as well. There is someone that's going to protect them from violence and so forth in the form of a husband, ideally, providing he's a good husband. And so really it was survival before love. Now when marriage was set up in Eden, the center of it was love, wasn't it? Because that was a perfect environment. But very soon you can see if you're in danger, you're more concerned about survival than you are about love. So marriage is about whether or not this guy can, I'm going to marry this guy based on whether or not he can feed me and my family, not so much on whether or not I love him. And so that's it's very different. It's different to our culture today because we're much more secure, I suppose, with some of those things. We can think more about love in relationships, but for them, it was survival. Very important indeed. Marriage ensured the propagation of the familial line. It enabled increased comfort, security, and likelihood of survival to be built up by families over generations. So, okay, I've got it really tough here, but I'm going to set up covenants with these guys and those guys and these guys, and I'm going to get married and I'm going to have a big family. So my next generation, they're going to have it better than I did. And then these guys are going to work really hard, and the next generation is going to have it even better because they'll have all of these relationships going on. And this is how you see this going on in the life of Abraham. That he builds up his servants, he builds up his flocks and herds and so forth, all right? And in fact, Ruth draws on this multi-generational covenantal language towards Naomi in chapter 1, verse 16 to 17. Your people will be my people and your God my God. She's making a covenant there. But what happens if something goes wrong? If somebody dies or falls into debt or gets murdered, how are the dependents provided for? What happens then? How is the people that he's supposed to take care of looked after? How is the line preserved and how is the land sustained? It's very important in this culture that the allotted land for each family stays in that family because that's a part of how God blessed his people by giving them this section of land. So if there's some poor financial management or poverty and that land gets given to somebody else or even given to a Gentile or another clan, well, what will happen? You know, that's that's bad because this is part of the inheritance of God. And so there's got to be a process to fix that. And the way that was done is by what's called the kinsman redeemer. Now, I'm going to be telling you some information. And if you want to read it from the Bible, you can see, you can take a picture of the screen and I've got the verses up there. But I'll just tell it to you for the sake of brevity, right? So a kinsman redeemer, sometimes in some situations called the avenger of blood, and sometimes, also they're responsible for what's called levirate marriage. And this was a close relative that was, it was his responsibility to fix the problem if something went wrong. He was the closest male relative. He had the responsibility, if he could, providing he had the money or the ability to do so, he would purchase land when a mortgage defaulted and he'd brick it back into the clan. That was one of his responsibilities. He would buy back a man who had sold himself into servitude. In those days, they had the year of jubilees that happened every so often where everybody was set free. But often it was a practice, if you fell into debt, you would sell yourself as a slave to serve off that debt for the remainder of the time until jubilees. And so a kinsman redeemer might buy that person back or pay off their debt. They would ensure that someone who murdered a member of their family received justice. It was their responsibility, if there was a murder in their family, to make sure that the killer was tracked down. It was their responsibility to care for the widow, and they would do that with the covenant of marriage. So, for example, if a cousin or a brother passed away, then, and you know, if my brother or my cousin passed away, it'd be my responsibility to marry that woman, that widow, and then I bring her into my family, and I have to take care of her. Someone's got to feed her, and guess who it is? It's me. I've got to look after her. And awkwardly enough, I suppose, also to provide an heir for the dead relative through that marriage. And I'm not quite sure how they were able to do that, but anyhow, this is part of the responsibilities because the line cannot die out. The line has to remain for the God's blessings to be seen in the people. So the line has to remain. And so the man's got to provide an heir for his dead relative. And that heir, That heir, as he grows, becomes responsible for caring for his aged mother. So he becomes the redeemer for the mother. Does that make sense? So you can see what's the importance of what's at play here. Here is Ruth and Naomi going into poverty and how desperate it is for them to have a redeemer. This is the word in Hebrew. It's Goel, Goel. And by the way, also used as a name for God in the scripture. Remember, Job said, I know that my Redeemer lives and he will stand at the latter day upon the earth. And even though my body worms destroy, even my flesh shall I see God. Yeah, my Redeemer lives. But a Redeemer, in order to be a kinsman Redeemer, you had to have two things. You had to be in the same family and you had to be able to do what needed to be done. If you didn't have the money to buy, you didn't have to buy. But if you had it, you had to do it. You with me? So you had to be able to do it and you had to be a close relative. That's the two things. With that in mind, let's read the first 10 chapters. Oh, the first 10 verses, rather, of the chapter. Meanwhile, Boaz went up to the town gate, and he sat there. When the kinsman redeemer he had mentioned came along, Boaz said, come over here, my friend, and sit down. So he went over and sat down. Now, just for context here, remember that Boaz had made it, promised Ruth that he was going to follow through with what she'd asked. He was going to try and attempt to get her hand, but he said there is a redeemer closer to her. There was a closer relative, and he had to try and sort the situation out legally first, so that he could marry this woman. That, as it seems like he wants to. It seems like there's a level of love and attraction, and anyway, let's move on. Verse 2. Boaz took 10 of the elders of the town and said, "Sit here," and they did so. Then he said to the kinsman redeemer, "Naomi, who has come back from Moab, is selling the piece of land that belonged to our brother." Two pages rather than one. Elimelech. I thought I should bring the matter to your attention and suggest that you buy it in the presence of these seated here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, do so. But if you will not, tell me, so I will know. For no one has the right to do it except you, and I am the next in line. You notice that he doesn't mention Ruth at all. He talks about the man's land. See that? Now, there's a level of faith here, because he doesn't really want the land. Men have got a great way of being able to acquire things that they want. If he wanted the land, he would have bought it already. He wanted Ruth. So why did he mention the land first? You know, sometimes in your life, Sometimes in our life, there is an outcome that you want, but there's a process that has to be gone to get through it. And there is always a little bit of a temptation within us to try and control the outcome when it's God's alone to give to us. You know, and so what I appreciate here about Boaz is that he respects the process. He is honoring the fact that God has put this system in place for the providence of family. And rather than trying to control the outcome, he's allowing things to take their course. And so he mentions the property, and guess what? The man replies, "I will redeem it," he said. And as a reader, everyone's, well, because we're barracking for Boaz and Ruth, aren't we? We want them to get together. And when he says, "Yeah, okay, I'll redeem it," we go, "No, no." And so he says, "Okay, that's okay. You can redeem it. BT Dubs." Or, by the way, there's a woman as well. Verse 5. "And then Boaz said, 'On the day that you buy the land from Naomi and from Ruth, the Moabitess, you acquire the dead man's widow in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property.' At this, the kinsman redeemer said, 'Then I cannot redeem it because I might endanger my own estate. You redeem it yourself. I cannot do it.'" Whew! And there's a big sigh of relief. God worked it out. Praise God. Why might he have said no to this? Well, probably, I don't know because the text doesn't say, but there's a number of reasons. It's quite a tricky situation when you start, you know, having children that are also your nieces and nephews. Do you know what I mean? And like, I suspect based on how he's responded that he's probably married already and that he has perhaps either no children or daughters and hasn't yet had a son. And if he were to marry Ruth and she were to conceive a son, then he maybe risks the fact of his own estate going to his relative's son, and then his wife ends up in the same situation as Ruth was in. Does that make sense? So that's my theory of perhaps what's going on for him. Now, in actual fact, he was required by law to do this. There was a way out. He could absolutely refuse to do it. And the law in Deuteronomy, I think, I put the verse up earlier, is that if he absolutely refused to take care of a widow that he was supposed to take care of, she could take away his sandal and then spit in his face, and then everyone would like shame him because he wouldn't do his responsibility of taking care of people that should be taken care of his family. So in this case, because it's negotiated with Boaz, he actually still loses his sandal, but it's not a shameful thing. Okay, so we're going to read on. And it says, where do we get up to here? Verse 6, right? It says, "Now in earlier times in Israel, for the redemption and transfer of property to become final, one party took off his sandal and gave it to the other. This was the method of legalizing transactions in Israel." In actual fact, the practice had been extended from this to other contracts as well, we find in verse 7, which is a pretty interesting way of solidifying a contract if you think about it. Like if I were to want to make a promise to somebody and I were to take off my shoe, you know, and give it to them. So it's a weird way to solidify a contract, isn't it? Does anybody want that? I don't know why that would be, but I have the sense, just having traveled around this area, the Fertile Crescent is quite beautiful, but around the area is pretty, there's a lot of desert, a lot of rocks. I think it would be very difficult to walk long distances with only one sandal. I think maybe it's a way of saying, "I'm not going to run away. I'm going to fulfill what I've promised to do. I can't run away now because you've got my shoe." Does that make sense? Right? Okay, so I think that's what's going on. Verse 8. "So the kinsman redeemer said to Boaz, 'Buy it yourself,' and he removed his sandal. Verse 9, then Boaz announced to the elders of all the people, 'Today you are witnesses that I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Chilion and Mahlon. I have also acquired Ruth the Moabitess, Mahlon's widow, as my wife, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property, so that his name will not disappear from among his family or from the town records. Today you are all witnesses.'" Okay. You just don't see contracts happen like this anymore in the world, do you? Very interesting. But here's some things to notice. Have a look in verse 11 to 12. It says, "Then the elders and all those at the gate said, 'We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, who has together built up the house of Israel. May you have standing in Ephrathah and be famous in Bethlehem through the offspring the Lord gives you by this young woman. May your family be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. Can you see the blessing that the witnesses of the town place upon them? Give me some key words or some key places and names out of that blessing, just so that I know that you're reading and listening. Bethlehem, is that a significant town? Why? Okay, all right. And what else? Judah, is that significant? Why is it significant? Yeah, right, okay. So the line of Judah, yeah. Right, so we've got Judah, Ephrathah. We're going to keep these in mind because I'm going to show you something about them later. Critical familial and locational details for us to notice. This blessing that gets placed on them is that they will be like Judah. Because they're descendants of Judah, or rather Boaz is. Okay, so just read on, verse 13. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife, and then he went to her, and they enabled her. The Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. Can you notice who enabled her to conceive? Does it say? The Lord. So we've got the Lord involved in the process. There's a supernatural manifestation of God's presence here, and this descendant that is as a result of the movement of the Lord. It's a wonderful thing. It reminds us of all these times throughout the history of God's people where God has got involved in a son being conceived. Like, remember Isaac and Samuel, and later on we had Samson, and then who else? Well, the big one is there's a big supernatural birth that's all the way down in who? Jesus. There we go, right? So this the way that God is involved in the process is very significant in the narrative. Let's read on. We read verse 14 to 17. It says, the woman said to women. The women said to Naomi, who are they speaking to? Naomi. Is that the daughter or the mother-in-law? Good, because by this point, sometimes the names get mixed up in people's head and they lose track of who's who. So I just want to be clear about that. Okay, praise be to the Lord who this day has not left you without a kinsman redeemer. Who's the kinsman redeemer for Naomi? Wait a minute. May he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age, for your daughter-in-law who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons has given him birth. Who's the kinsman redeemer for Naomi? It has become this child, right? This little child has become the redeemer for Naomi. Boaz redeemed Ruth, but Obed, we're going to find out his name's Obed later, redeems Naomi. He becomes responsible for caring for Naomi as she gets older. And we're not sure how long Naomi lived exactly, whether or not Obed actually had to do that or if she passed away, we're not sure. But anyhow, that's the legal responsibility. And these women bless them. These women bless them. This is really interesting that women play such a prominent role in this story. This story, the book of Ruth, it is a female-driven narrative. It really is. Everything that men do in this story is either unwise, so that's the men going to Moab in the first place, or else, if they do something wise, it's a response to a female initiative. The women are driving the whole story, and they become critically important. Critically important. The child Obed becomes Naomi's redeemer, who will care for her as she ages. And it says Ruth is better than what? Seven sons. This is a part of the female blessing. She is such a blessing to you. She's better than seven sons. Seven, as you know, is significant in Scripture. It is a symbol of perfection. And to have seven sons was an amazing thing. But Ruth is better, it says. This points to the critical role of a special young woman in God's grand plan to bring a redeemer to the world. Right back in Genesis 3, God made a prophecy to the enemy. And he said, I will put enmity between you and, do you know, the woman, between thy seed and her seed. He will crush your head, but you will strike his heel. And what does it say? When the time came, Jesus came born of woman, born under the law. So the critical role that woman plays in salvation history. Okay, let's read verse 18 to 22. And it says, this then is the family line of Perez. Perez was the father of Hezron. Hezron was the father of Ram. Ram the father of Amminadab. Amminadab the father of Nahshon. Nahshon the father of Salmon. Salmon the father of Boaz. Boaz the father of Obed. Obed the father of Jesse. And Jesse the father of who? Okay, come with me to Matthew chapter 1. Matthew chapter 1, you can leave your finger in Ruth if you want to. Actually, I don't think we'll come back to it. We'll just leave it there. Come over to Matthew chapter 1. We're going to read a few verses out of it. This is the chapter so lovingly known as the Begats, and it's the one that most people skip when they start reading the New Testament because it doesn't make any sense to them. But this is the very family tree of Jesus Christ. Excuse me. Okay, we're going to read verse 1, 2, 3, first of all. It says, a record of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac. Isaac was the father of Jacob. Jacob, the father of Judah and his brothers. Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. There was a reference to that in what we read before in Ruth, wasn't it? Let's jump forward to verse 5 and 6. And it says, Salmon, the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. Boaz, the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. There's Ruth mentioned there again. Obed, the father of Jesse, and Jesse, the father of King David. And then we go to verse 16, which says, and Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, who was born of Jesus, who is called Christ. You know what? These family trees are so important in establishing the importance of the history of how God chooses to bring his Redeemer into the world. And we can trace the family of Jesus Christ all the way back to this beautiful story. And within this story, we see so many parallels of his coming. So why does it matter? Well, the way I think it matters is actually in Revelation chapter 5. So we're going to read a few verses in Revelation 5, and then we're going to round up, okay? So Revelation chapter 5, and as we go through, now if you've ever read Revelation 4, that's quite a read, but we're looking into the very heavenly sanctuary of God. We're looking into the very throne room of God in heaven. And it says in chapter 5 and verse 1, it says, then I saw in the right hand of him who sat on the throne, who is who? Who sits on the throne in heaven? Okay, God the Father, thank you. A scroll with writing on both sides and sealed with what? Seven seals. Okay, what does that mean? Let's read verse 2. And I saw a mighty angel proclaiming in a loud voice, who is worthy to break the seals and open the scroll? Okay. So this goes back to the kinsman redeemer stuff again. So if you had to sell your property because you got into debt, this is what you do. This is what I alluded to it before, but this was the process. Okay, so you'd make a contract and that became the deed to your property. You'd roll it up into a book and seal it. Both parties got duplicates. Every 50th year, which was called Jubilees, you got your property back. But if you wanted it back early, you could buy it. And you would get your kinsman redeemer, who would go to the person, act as an intermediary, or provide the money themselves, pay the price, get your book, unseal it, and then kick the buyer out of the property. That's the process. Okay. And there's actually an example of this in Jeremiah, which you can look at in your own time. When we get to this idea of book in Bible prophecy, there's one mentioned in Daniel 12, there's another one in Isaiah. There's this critical idea of a sealed book that represents the whole history of God's people. God's people are in need of being redeemed because they've sold themselves into slavery. This whole world is in need of being redeemed because it's been sold into slavery. This sealed book contains the rights of ownership to this planet, but also the spiritual condition of God's people and the entire destiny of the human family. And so that's the reason why we get to verse 3 and 4 of Revelation chapter 5. It says, but no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth could open the scroll or even look inside it. And I wept because no one was found who was worthy to open the scroll or to look inside. Can you see why John's weeping here? Because the stakes are so high. Who could possibly be a go-between between God and man? When we sin, we give the whole world or all the rights of our rulership of this world and our race over to the devil. God the Father has a duplicate of this contract. Now, I don't know if that's a literal thing, or I think that it's more of probably a symbol here of the state of man, and that it's pictured, symbolic language. But anyhow, this is the way it's pictured in Revelation 5. But we need a kinsman redeemer to pay the price, to buy back our land, and to deliver us from slavery, to take us into his home. to provide for us and punish the one who is a murderer from the beginning. John weeps because who can be found that could do that? Who could possibly be in our human family? One who is like us, but also someone who is divine and perfect to pay the price for sin with the power to evict and destroy the devil. But the good news is, we get to verse 5, and it says, "Then one of the elders said to me," what? "Do not weep, for the Lion of the tribe of Judah," the tribe of who? "The root of David," or the descendant of David, of who? "Has triumphed, and he's able to open the scroll and its seven seals." And then he sees this kinsman redeemer. And it says, "I saw a lamb looking as if it had been slain, standing in the center of the throne." And so now we can see the fullness of the implication of what Ruth points to here. This whole book, the story of some tribal contract that happened thousands of years ago in this little ancient Near Eastern town in the middle of nowhere, that really shouldn't have had any impact whatsoever on the history of humanity. God chooses to step in and use these women to bring forth his kinsman redeemer. Isn't that awesome? What does that tell you about what he can do with you? Here's all the references in Ruth that we see fulfilled here. This idea of being of the tribe of Judah. There's a reference to Genesis 49, 9 to 10. Descended from David, or root of David. We saw that in the verses. There's some prophecies about the Messiah being of the line of David. Born in Bethlehem. I love that prophecy in Micah 5. "Thou, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you be small among the thousands of Judah, yet out from you will come forth one who is going forth from of old, even from everlasting." Amazing. Supernaturally of woman, word become flesh. Have you ever thought about the fact that in Jesus, God became flesh? John chapter 1 says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was with the beginning with God." And then it says in verse 14, "The Word became flesh and dwelt among us." Who else could be our kinsman redeemer but the God-man? God-man. Hebrews 7:26 says, "Such a high priest became us." Became us. I love that verbiage. I love that use of that phrase. So often you don't feel like God really understands what you're going through. But such a one became you. And in John 1:29, John the Baptist looks at his cousin Jesus, this descendant of Judah, this descendant of Boaz, walking down the bank of the Jordan River, and he said, "Look, it's the Lamb of God that takes away the sin of the world." Deuteronomy 32, when Moses was giving his farewell sermon, he said, "You know what? You guys have got to make atonement every time you have your priestly duties and sacrifices and everything. There's a lot of atonement that needs to be made. But guess what? One day God himself is going to step in and make atonement for the land and for the people." Descendant of the Ruth, the Moabitess. Jesus Christ is our kinsman redeemer. And he did that. He paid that price for us at the cross, didn't he? The only one that could pay it. The only one that was sinless, the only one that was divine, the only one that was strong enough to step down and do what needed to be done. This guy's name's, I'll just tell you about this guy and then I'll call it, okay? So this guy's name's Jason Coulthiss. He lives in South Queensland on the Gold Coast, okay? And he has got, in my opinion, second to mine, the best job in the world. What he does is he finds old amusement machines from like fairs and arcades and things, and they're all just, you know, not working, and he does them up and he sells them. And I think that would be a really fun job. I don't know about you. This is him with a little horse racing game from an old country fair from many years ago, and he's fixing it up. Here's some befores and afters. Oh, there's an old carnival ride that he's fixing. Look at this. This is one of those old machines, you know, those love machines. You used to put in a coin and they tell you, you know, whether or not you're a good potential partner. Did anyone ever do anything stupid like that, like waste your money in that way? Maybe you don't want to admit it. But anyway, these things were pretty common in carnivals and amusement centers, you know, shows and things like that. And people would go and put a coin in and they'd tell them if they were a good kisser or anything like that. But you know what? I think that's stupid. But you look at what he's done. You know, he's taken something so decrepit and broken down and he's made it beautiful. I love that. Have a look at this. This is one of those old strength testing machines. And there was different forms of these at carnival. Sometimes they'd give you a big mallet and you had to hit something and it'd tell you whether or not you were strong, or you know, you'd have to pull something or squeeze something or whatever. But anyway, look at the before and after, just beautiful. Just beautiful what somebody that cares, somebody that can look at something that's broken and decrepit and see value in it and do what needs to be done to restore it, to pay the money. It's expensive to do some of this work, to pay the money that needs to be paid to restore it and to bring out of it what they see in it. You know what's required for a process like that? Somebody that can look at something not as it is, but as it could be. Do you know when God looks at you, he doesn't see all of your sin? When you put your life in Jesus' hands, he sees his righteousness, is what he sees. He doesn't judge you by your sin when you put your life in his hands. He judges you by what Jesus did for you at the cross. Isn't that wonderful? He doesn't look at you and see what you are. He sees what you can be in him. And I want to just ask you as we finish up, are you in need of a kinsman redeemer? Because I am. These are the questions that I was asking myself at 4 a.m. this morning when I was finishing this PowerPoint. And I was going, "What do I need a kinsman redeemer?" And I was just thought about, how am I someone that needs to be redeemed? Am I in slavery to sin? Am I in poverty spiritually or physically? Am I grieving and bereaved? Have I made decisions that have caused me to lose things that matter to me? Am I unable to care for myself? Am I oppressed and too tired to fight anymore? If you resonate with any of those questions, you're in need of a kinsman redeemer, and I've got tremendous news for you. You can be redeemed because God buys broken things. We're going to sing our last song together.